You know how it goes. You're walking down Lover's Lane, possibly with a raspberry tart in hand. And maybe you have an amethyst brooch you borrowed temporarily. You go for a row on the Lake of the Shining Waters. Perhaps you wear a dress with puffed sleeves. Then Gilbert Blythe comes in the room. Swoon. Big swoon. Wait, hold on now. No one lives a life like this, right? This is some straight up PEI nonsense. Lucy Maud Montgomery is just trolling us all the way to the bank. Or is it? What if I were to introduce you to someone who might as well have been in the schoolroom in Avonlea?
What if I told you she has to go live by a desolate salt sea, and her husband disappears, and her next husband just ignores her most of the time?
But does she want to live in a world with Octobers? Because I do.
Probably.
I'm so glad I live in a world of Octobers and crickets. Okay. Or you could go all Pringle on my happy little scene. Thanks. That was a nice little tapestry I was weaving there. Thank you for ruining it.
You're welcome.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Ma'am, can I encourage you to quit writing ads for Rollings Reliable for just a hot minute? Because we need to hear from our fancy new sponsor, our friends at the University of Utah Press. For decades, they have been publishing seminal works of Mormon history. Hal Schindler's bio of Porter Rockwell, David O. McKay and the Rise of Modern Mormonism.
And they reprinted Juanita Brooks's edition of the Hosea Stout Diaries and her selected letters, and eventually my book.
This is all true. What we're saying is that we're fans of the UVU Press.
Big fans.
Among their gems is one very applicable for today. Emmeline B. Wells was the most noted Utah Mormon woman of her time. Lauded nationally for her energetic support of the women's rights movement of the 19th century, she was a self-made woman who channeled her lifelong sense of destiny into ambitious altruism. Her public acclaim and activism belied the introspective, self-appraising, and emotional persona she expressed in the pages of her 47 extant diaries. Yet she wrote, "I have risen triumphant," after reconciling herself to the heartaches of plural marriage, and she pursued a self-directed life in earnest. This new biography tells the story of the private Emmeline, the unusual circumstances of her marriages, the complicated lives of her five daughters, losses and disappointments interspersed with bright moments and achievements, all engendered the idea that her life was a romance, with all the mysterious, tragic, and sentimental elements of that genre. Her responses to that perception made it so. This volume, drawing heavily on Emmeline Wells' own words, tells the complicated story of a woman of ambition, strength, tenderness, and faith. Emmeline B. Wells, An Intimate History by Karen Cornwall Madsen, published by the University of Utah Press. Check them out at uofupress.com.
Okay, fine. I can't give you Anne Shirley Cuthbert.
Can we settle for Diana Barry?
No, not even Ruby Gillis. It's time for a world-famous...
Raspberry cordial?
Will you calm down over there? No, and we don't drink raspberry cordials in Dixie, Brian. No, we welcome your ears to another round of Before They Were Famous.
Rather walk a ridgepole.
Listen, you want to be Rachel Lind, you do it on your own time. We gotta get down to business. Our own Anne Shirley Cuthbert. A one named Emmeline Blanche Woodward. not just going to narrate herself. Well, actually, with 47 volumes of diaries of her names, she kind of could, actually.
What about the 25-year gap in her diaries?
Sir, do I need to get Marilla down here?
I'll be good.
That's better. Today's story is probably the high water mark of Mormon women's history, so show some respect. We have a woman who left thousands of pages of diaries, and they're not only digitized, my friends, they are transcribed and annotated, so why aren't we all reading those all the time? We have two very good biographies of her, one that zooms in on her life as a public figure, especially in the suffrage movement. The other, both are by Carol Cornwall Madsen, by the way, is a traditional cradle to the grave look at her complete life. And goodness gracious, you guys, what a life. She lived 93 incredibly busy years.
Try this on. She's born 2 years before the Book of Mormon introduced Kiriloms and Cumoms to a waiting world, and then she lives into the roaring 20s. That's bonkers. But before we get too deep in these picturesque weeds, petition to step back a bit.
Petition always granted. Let's share a few general thoughts from her biographer. Madsen described Emmeline like this, quote, "I think of her as a woman triumphant because despite the unyielding grip with which a plethora of challenges seized her throughout her life and her strong penchant for entertaining sorrow, she moved forward with equally extraordinary determination to resist these disabling forces." What a thoroughly Victorian but also modern sounding person. And I also found this intriguing, quote, "She protected the introspective, emotional reflections of her inner world from the curious minds and quick judgments of her peers, the public and her rivals. She carefully constructed a facade of willed pleasantry to hide the mercurial life within."
What did she have to be so mercurial about?
The P.
Patriarchy?
Yeah, well, that P too, but also the other one.
Politics?
Yeah. Okay, that one too, but also the other one.
Polygyny!
Fine, no more whispers. Yes, you nerd.
Okay. Yeah, I can see how that particular P would cause some mercuriality. Madsen also argues that Emmeline wouldn't have seen herself as a feminist, even if that word had existed then, but she definitely saw herself as progressive. I mean, if you're on a first-name basis with Susan B. Anthony, that kind of qualifies you for that. But as a very public defender of the old P, that put her in a weird limbo. So, and also she's in a fishbowl that whole time. Carol also helpfully explains the power that Emmeline's native Massachusetts held over her. In the course of her research, Carol actually went and visited all the places that Emmeline called home, and she concluded, quote, "Basking in the natural world of tall pines, languid streams, and verdant meadows that surrounded these quaint mill towns enabled me to understand why the sense of place had so beguiled her and held such power in her mind and memories. Her nature resonated the natural world's many moods, from the hope and expectancy of spring to the shadowed cold and dark of winter."
And Shirley Cuthbert alert! I mean, if you describe all of this in fictionalized autobiography titled Hepzibah, where you include touches of pathetic sweetness and the holy calm of a summer twilight, you might as well just have Miss Stacy look at your manuscript when you're done. So, just for kicks, Emmeline's mom was named Diadama. Diadama
sounded right.
Okay, all those judgy people that just think my IQ is low because I can't read this, I just want to point this out. When would you ever have to say these words out loud? You know, you're always reading them. Diadama.
Rarely reading them at that.
You should be reading them more. Pretty sure Anne wanted to name a daughter that, and so it fits more into our Anne of Green Gables again. So I like this theme. And Emmeline was born on February 29th. Yes. She was born in a leap year, so she does not exist. You can't make this stuff up. She would later describe the little town where she was born like this, quote, "A village nestled down among the hills, with quaint old-fashioned houses low and brown, and pictured like some old neglected mills, in days gone by the pride of all the town."
Big Anne Shirley alert there. We're not going to say much about her father David because he died not long after her first birthday. Technically, it was her fourth birthday because, you know, leap year. Those kids never let you forget their birthdays are wonky. You know who you are.
Do you have a leap year, baby?
No.
Like, how do you do that?
It's just weird.
You just ignore them every once in a while? Pretend they were never born?
It's nature's way. And Emmeline had sisters named Adeline Pallas. That's P-A-L-L-A-S. And that's a Greek god. And don't fret your gizzard. I had to look that one up too. And a sister named Cordelia. Exactly. The name Anne Shirley really wanted to have.
Emmeline was very fond of going to her grandfather's house. It's a red farmhouse, apple trees, big barn. Mary Oliver would be all over this. Attic with herbs drying on the roof beams, barrels of nuts, and of course, a garret. Emmeline would go there, play school with her rag dolls for students. We can't skip this gem from the biography, quote, "Dressing up in her grandmother's silks, she composed verses of fairy tales, which she sometimes recited to the family as well as to her rag dolls." I love her.
That's peak and Shirley alert.
Right so there. Cute.
So we mentioned that Emmeline's father died when she was 4. Her mother managed to keep the family of 8 children afloat, and then she remarries 2 years later. There's one little offhand comment about him in Emmeline's diary that hints that her stepfather just kind of sucked, and he disappears with little trace. Not even a buffalo trace. And hold that thought. And despite that, Emmeline continued to live this Avonlea-esque existence with a moss-covered well, a brook next to the house, and lots of flowers.
Now, this next little vignette is by no means central to her story, but as the people who magnanimously gave the world soaking, we simply can't pass it up. All crushes start to be a thing, right? The boys and girls would go into the forest among the chestnut trees. The boys would refuse to go up to the branches and shake loose the nuts unless the girls agreed to kiss them. Typical stuff. And Emmeline said, quote, "Submitting gracefully was the wisest course to pursue. Besides, how could we go home with empty baskets?" The activity was named, unfortunately, nutting. We will not even attempt to deal with the layers of Victorian, who knows, contained within the whole thing.
Couple other vintage touches. Madsen points out that they were strict Congregationalists who did not celebrate Christmas. Emmeline explained that was because Christmas was connected with Episcopals, or Church of England people, or worst of all, Roman Catholics. Sorry, Christina. As a result of this, Thanksgiving was the big holiday. It had a lot of the trappings of Christmas. Decorations, a big family dinner, family members coming back into town, all of that kind of thing. The one interesting element was that it was either late November or even early December, because a regular date for Thanksgiving wasn't a thing until Lincoln and the Civil War. Probably after Lincoln read the Book of Mormon.
You get out of here with your Tim Ballard nonsense. Luckily, Emmeline was able to attend school. What's wild is that the terms were just 8 weeks during summer and then 10 weeks in winter. Farming, people. That's how it goes. Because that was absolutely the backbone of the economy, everybody had to be ready to help out, particularly the youths, back when child labor was a thing. Since they didn't have the TikTok to ruin their lives and society with, they were perfect candidates to get out there and hoe it up. No, not like the TikTok way.
Not the nutting way.
Sort of like when we talked about Emma, her mother recognized Emmeline was something unusual, so she went to live with their sister to go to a better school. And eventually her mother figured out a way to send her to the New Salem Academy, a private school. You tell me her mother's real name isn't Marilla. I'll wait. And just to make sure you understand how cool and important this was, listen to how Carol Cornwall Madsen summarized the watershed period, quote, "When Emmeline's mother enrolled her daughter at the academy, she gave her daughter a gift of I don't know that I can say this word. Say it again.
Benimi?
Oh, stop it. It's too early to get there. Inestimable value. It would become the vehicle that carried her along the winding road of her life and enabled her to reach what she believed her angels of destiny had in store for her. Education at the academy and her natural talents lifted Emmeline's sights above the limitations of her social origins and eventually made her one of the growing number of female literary and educated women who were her models of achievement."
Church was a very big part of Emmeline's life. She was in the choir, and life is just kind of steaming right along.
Was that ominous at all? Sounded maybe like a little ominous.
No, not at all. I mean, yeah, sure, there's some Mormon missionaries spreading throughout New England.
I knew it. Ominous.
Okay, fine. Mild amounts of ominosity. Possibly even ominousness. Emmeline's minister had heard what was up nearby, so he refused to let them preach in his church. Apparently, he'd heard from the Reverend John Fielding in England that if you let Mormons in your church, bad things happen. He also apparently had one-on-ones with basically everyone in the congregation and warned them about those filthy missionaries.
Things changed when a local woman was apparently healed of her years-long paralysis and she walked to her baptism. Emmeline said it was the most exciting thing anyone in her little village could remember. Emmeline's mother, Diadema, was the first domino to fall in her house. Two of her younger sisters also joined at the same time, and the older siblings, married and or living outside the home, couldn't believe mom had been punked and tried to talk her out of it. Please don't join the Mormons, Mommy. They're bad. Mom leaned into it and actually took Emmeline out of school so she could hear what the missionaries had to say. And Emmeline really liked the style of singing and praying. That was apparently as much of an impact as it had on her. She went back to school mostly thinking her own mother was a little bit crazy too.
But she kept thinking it over. One of her best friends had been baptized. Even though she couldn't quite understand what Mom saw in the Mormons, she had always followed very closely what Mom did. So Emmeline, appropriately enough, given her literary life, paints this very dramatic scene of what happened next. It was a cold, gray March morning, 1842. It was her 14th birthday. No leap years. I will not say it was her third and a half birthday. We're done with that noise. During the night, Emmeline said that two powers were warring within her.
Emmeline continued, quote, "One said, 'Obey your mother. Go down in the waters of baptism in the little brook that always seemed a sanctuary.' And the other voice said, 'Do not heed the sayings of your mother or the elders. A brilliant future awaits you. You must not make the sacrifice.'" They had to cut a hole in the ice for the baptisms. She's one of those. Emmeline finally chose to follow her mother. But up until the very moment she enters into the water, she has townspeople gathered around her trying to talk her out of it. Can you imagine? The way Emmeline describes her decision, it was much less a vote for Mormonism than it was joining her mother.
The success of the missionaries in the area created a situation that we've talked about before, and this was something that really hit me when we went to England. The other side of early Mormon missionary success that gets forgotten is what happens to these places when all these shiny new Mormons decide to gather. Emmeline would later say her village, quote, "never became afterwards what it had been in other days." She argued that, quote, "many of the very best and brightest men and women went with that little band of pilgrims and their places were not filled."
Emmeline then went back to school to be the stereotypical only Mormon in the school trope. And she finished up and was ready to now be a teacher, checking off what will likely be the last box on her Anne Shirley card. No, there is no alternative universe in which Anne is a plural wife. Don't anyone dare try to fanfic that. There are limits, and that is wrong. After two hurdles, an examination and certification from her minister, tough since, you know, Mormonism, she got the Beechwood School. This is where Beechwood comes from. Did you know what her pen name is? Blanche Beechwood.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
I'm just putting this together. She got the Beechwood School and started her teaching career. Can we add that in later? The Beechwood part? Or should I just say right here?
At the end, I talk about, I think we got to do at least one more on her when she starts like Woman's Exponent and everything.
Okay.
We'll throw that in there. But remember that. I forgot about that.
Yeah, she got the Beechwood School and started her teaching career. And Emmeline would later describe this as one of the happiest periods of her life. And fun fact, Beechwood School, I'm just seeing the name, her pen name later on in the exponent is Blanche Beechwood, which is fun. Now we know why.
Wait, the way you describe that, that smells ominous again.
Well, you are the expert on smelling around here. So fine, you're correct.
And it just so happens that a group of Mormons were preparing to gather to Nauvoo. Mom wasn't quite ready to go yet, but she wanted Emmeline to go. She was worried Emmeline wasn't going to stick with Mormonism, so what's better than just ship her off to Church HQ? The plan is for Emmeline to go with branch president Elias Harris' family and her new husband, fellow 15-year-old James. Oh, did we forget to mention that the plan included them getting married? Yeah, we forgot about that. Apparently someone also forgot to mention it to Emmeline, because she starts getting confused when James pitches woo in her general direction. However, Emmeline is, of course, a hopeless romantic and reader of novels, so when James smooches her and proposes, she's on board.
Was there poetry to celebrate the occasion?
Oh, gee, LHP, I don't know. Did the calendar say it was the Victorian era?
Fine, I already know the answer. Here we go. "The fountains within were deeply stirred by a strange, sweet music, exquisitely rare. For someone had whispered, 'Will thou be mine?' and a kiss as delicious as honeydew." Yeah, that sounds about right. The way Emmeline painted the scene, life as a small Mormon fish in a large Gentile pond, wasn't super fun, so leaving town alongside her new sweetie pie sounded just fine. They were married by the local justice of the peace. And oddly enough for Emmeline, the wedding wasn't all strawberries and cream. Part of that was apparently due to something that had been around as long as the Mormons. The Mormon mother-in-law. Lucy Harris, no, not that Lucy Harris. Smart guy. Mother-in-law Lucy Harris.
Given what we've told you about Emmeline so far, I bet you can actually finish the sentence. Lucy thought that Emmeline would spend all day reading novels rather than making hardtack over an open fire, or, I don't know, whatever the hell she's supposed to be doing. Now, Emmeline did not leave a record of which wedding present she liked the most, but we do know definitely which one she hated the most, because she was gifted the opportunity of living with her mother-in-law, like, every day for 9 months.
I will share my professional opinion here, and that all sounds absolutely terrible. Emmeline would later write about realizing that she wasn't making her own decisions. They were 100% being made for her. Who out there knows the struggle, am I right? She would say, quote, "I cannot tell it here, not even after all these years. My destiny changed, or the course of my life drifted into an entirely different channel from that heretofore anticipated by me. This was as completely a turning point as one could possibly have." And as she mused on these developments in the following decades, her biographer notes that this defined Emmeline's life, quote, "resilience, self-confidence, and self-direction within the framework of what she discerned as God's will."
After a final Christmas with her family in her beloved New England, the small group hitched up their proverbial wagons and set off for Joseph Smith's Nauvoo. With the benefit of hindsight, we would encourage them to, how would we phrase it?
Hurry the hell up.
Right, right. Well put. See, the calendar said April 24th, 1844 when they rolled out. If they want to see Wham! Featuring Joseph Smith in concert, they better get some butts in gear. Now, the journey wasn't quite going through the mud of Iowa, and that's mud with three Ds, obviously, but it wasn't fun either. Emmeline could sense the historic moment. I mean, you all can probably guess this, given her nature. She started her first journal as she left home. Oddly, she quit writing once they hit Buffalo. Not a Dalton Kincaid fan, obviously. She doesn't even write about reaching Nauvoo, which happened in mid-May 1844. Of course, listeners, you guys know by now, there's lots of peak cray Nauvoo moments, but mid-May 1844 it's up there.
Later in life, Emmeline would describe their arrival. Surprising no one, seeing Joseph Smith for the first time was front and center in her foundational memories. No, it wasn't "he's so tall and handsome as hell," but close. Quote, "his majestic bearing, so entirely different from anyone I had ever seen, was more than a surprise. It was as if I beheld a vision. Before I was aware of it, he came to me, and when he took my hand, I was simply electrified, thrilled through and through to the tips of my fingers and every part of my body as if some magic elixir had given me new life and vitality. The one thought that filled my soul was, I have seen the prophet of God. He has taken me by the hand." There's so much praising to the man here, we might need to get the hose. Calm down, Aunt Em.
So take a Utah minute, think back on the late Nauvoo episodes, remember how nuts things are at this point. Councils of 50s are dreaming up treasonous plots, the William Laws of the world are cranking out Nauvoo expositors, downriver Thomas Sharps are spilling angry ink, things is getting bonkos. And this, all of that, is Emmeline Wells' Nauvoo. Given the span and complexity of her life, it seems only fair that she enters Mormonia right at its craziest point. Now, on the calm front, Emmeline mapped some of her previous life onto the new one. She signed up for the choir there in town immediately. She and James found a place to live and just kind of settled into Nauvoo life. They went to listen to Joseph Smith speak every chance they had.
And you know what they didn't hear a whole lot about in Joseph's fancy sermons? The P. Like, next to nothing. What would Emmeline have heard about it? Well, okay, so certainly rumors are flying around, and it seems possible that they might have picked up on something, but maybe they just dismissed it as fake news? Good chance that that's the case, actually, because a lot of people did that. Emmeline doesn't seem to have reflected much on this, and I feel like we would have heard about it if she did. Part of the reason is probably just time. Remember that she's in Nauvoo for exactly one whole month before Joseph Smith is killed. However, even though she was a rookie, she's still on the team. And the team was sad. She later reminisced, quote, "how dark the clouds seemed to hang over the city of Nauvoo. It was as though the sun could not shine. The terrible sorrow and the darkness which seemed to cover the city like a funeral pall. It is utterly impossible to describe it to anyone who was not there to feel it."
All of that had to have been unbelievably difficult for Emmeline to wrap her head around. She'd only been a Mormon for 2 years and been a proud resident of Nauvoo for one solitary month. You wonder if her subconscious ever poked her and said, "hey, are we still sure this is such a great idea?" If that occurred to her, she doesn't ever seem to refer to it. All of this was cast in the usual tones, fiery ordeals and all of that. Like many others, she wrote about later being in the fateful meeting where Brigham makes his public, "trust me, I have game" speech, even swearing they all felt, quote, "it was the prophet Joseph himself risen again. It was a transfiguration, real and convincing."
Apparently, the extended family neglected to cover this in FHE because it got messy. You know what? My guess is somebody dropped the ball on the snack. That's probably what happened. That's what always screws it up. Honestly, if we can't come together and eat some brownies, then why are we even here in the first place? What we're trying to say is that the parents-in-law peaced out spiritually and physically. They lazy learned their butts to nearby La Harpe, Illinois, and as Carol Madsen describes it, they just figured James and Emmeline would come along. No dice. You just don't tell budding poets what to do.
If you're thinking that staying put as teenage transplants, if not dirtbags, sounds rough, it was. Emmeline later said that her earlier and Shirley-esque life had not prepared her for this. The Matthew Cuthbert of Nauvoo, yea, even the Prophet Joseph, was gone. And so were the adults in the room of their life. Even though she noted, quote, how severely we were put to the test, they find another place to live, and they doubled down as Brigham-flavored Mormonites.
Emmeline was tough. All 4'11 of... Excuse you, as I was saying, she was devoted to the... Oh, I see. This is actually a seg. Yes, bzz, indeed. Being the romantic that she was, Emmeline probably appreciated that the next development was the dreaded ague. Oh, and a baby. She had a baby. Because if there's anything better than having your first baby at 16, it's doing it while you have the shakes. Actually, what is so much more worse than that is when said baby also gets the ague and dies at 6 weeks.
Boo, boo.
She's 16, how sad. She was going through all of this when with just James by her side, and apparently his parents did not even acknowledge what happened.
And to compound all of these problems, they had absolutely no money. So, just to recap, the 16-year-old couple is facing the grief of their dead baby and crushing poverty. Is that what adult situations means in TV shows? Again, this all sounds absolutely terrible. The solution they come up with is James is going to hop on a boat headed downriver to St. Louis. It seems safe to assume this was not Emmeline's favorite idea. And it got better because the original plan was for him to just stay there 2 weeks. I don't know how that would have fixed anything, but when the egg timer hit 2 weeks, not only was James still meeting with Judy Garland in St. Louis, he told Emmeline, hey, why don't you just go move in with my family in La Harpe?
Just to make sure they were on the same page, Emmeline glanced down at her checklist. These are the parents who bailed on Mormonism? Check. This is the same sucky mother-in-law who hates me and my novel-reading lifestyle? Check. I had one of those too. And last question, these are the parents who are just pretending like the whole our baby died thing never happened? Checkmate. Madsen points out that Emmeline sunk into depression so much that it was months before she resumed her diary. James' absence stretched out with no end in sight. Quote, my life has been one continual round of troubles and afflictions, and it seems sometimes as if death would be a comfort. Yeah, it was not going well in the city of Joseph.
It is now moving day again for Emmeline. This time, she landed with Olive Bishop, who was tied to the Whitney family. Hold that thought. She returned to teaching with the small Whitney kiddos. She also got a patriarchal blessing. And no boring stuff like, you were super awesome and keep up the visiting teaching. No. She was told God would, quote, give thee a companion that shall hold the keys of the priesthood. If you remember, probably a long time ago, when we mentioned Brigham Young preaching that if a woman could find a dude with higher priesthood, she's basically just welcome to move on to him. Yeah, that's this idea. Okay, now remember that connection to the Whitney family you've been holding onto low for this one whole paragraph? It's back. Because Newell Whitney apparently proposes that she become his plural wife at this point.
And if you're thinking, uh-oh, James, you are about to get Dear John, or Brother John, you're correct, sir. Emmeline wrote a letter to Whitney in which she said, you have represented things to me strangely. Understatement, girl. She still hasn't made the year mark in Nauvoo. Her prophet has died. Her baby has died. Her husband is singing how the trolley is going clang, clang, clang down the river and doesn't seem too interested in coming home anytime soon. Now, she's getting a weird intro course on the P. And it wasn't a long course. Just 2 weeks after the patriarchal blessing and 3 months since James left, she marries Whitney. What? Do we need to mention that Brigham Young performed the ceremony? Probably not. Brigham Young performed the ceremony. Tough. We mentioned it anyway. Turns out that her roommate Olive was already Whitney's wife? That tended to happen a lot in Nauvoo. She would muse on all of this in an autobiographical poem. Just a heads up, there are some themes that you might not love, and here we go. In the poem, third person, Emmeline meets a noble stranger who tells her, quote, ah, little one, you sadly need a friend. Okay, this is true, sounds fine. Nor can you longer sorrow bear alone. Okay, yep, still true. All good here. He took her in his arms as her own father might.
Ugh.
Wait, what? No, big large no. No hard no. No matter which route this scene takes, we are not a fan of this. This is some Sylvia Plath stuff. Calling dude daddy in polygamy? Just say no.
What if I told you Whitney was 50? Would that make it better?
Huge, gigantic, unavoidable nope. That makes it worse. That's worse. That's not better.
If you're wondering what James had to say about all this, we invite you to sit in that. Like, forever. Because James totally disappeared. He's never heard from again. All things considered, Emmeline's new life with Whitney was actually fairly pleasant. They seemed to get along pretty well. Emmeline paints over the age disparity like only polygamists can, and grows to love him, it seems. I mean, the beginning is super rocky. Her journal is full of, "When will sorrow leave my bosom? And oppression has been my lot, and this day, like all others, is full of trouble." This one was so sad. She dreams that James is going to come back. Then a couple days after that, a steamboat arrives at Nauvoo. It's dusk. A dude gets off, comes toward her, and it's James. No, just kidding. It's definitely not. It's just some crappy store brand lookalike, and Emmeline is devastated. It's around this time she learns finally that James has gone to sea for 3 years. And yes, Anne Shirley would be happy to remind you, they used to build porches on the houses where the women can walk and look out to sea and wait for the dudes to return. Thoughts on James, you know, not informing her of any of this? Maybe some dynamite in the bottom of his ship? Luckily for you, LHP, you get a happier part.
Emmeline's sister and a granddaughter later wrote that Aunt Em apparently thought the marriage to Newell Whitney was an adoption. You know, just a rite that links her to him and his priesthood in the eternities. Not a normal marriage with a sexual component. And sister wives. Wait, I thought you said that this was a happier part.
That's a clerical error. On behalf of this podcast, we extend our sincere regret for this oversight.
Dynamite for your ship, too. We hit another gap in Emmeline's diaries for a few months, and I think we can venture some guesses as to why. The arrival of a group of more Mormons from her hometown, including two very good friends, seemed to cheer her up. What do we call people like that?
Bosom friend.
Close but not quite.
Kindred spirits.
Ah, there we go.
So at this point, Emmeline tried to lose herself. Not like that, weirdo. As I was saying before Marshall interrupted, she tried to lose herself in teaching. Her class is now anywhere from 30 to 40 students, so that was something. Her diary reveals she's trying to wean her emotions from James. Lot of that in polygamist diaries. This sounds like the Margaret Moon story. If you're curious if that's very common, yeah, of course it is. Then, that summer, her mother and her younger siblings finally show up, which had been about the best news in the world. It had been quite the journey. Mom had managed to get hornswoggled out of all of her money, and she also got knocked out at one point.
Mom hears about the fiasco with the Harris family and actually convinces Emmeline to reconcile. So, Emmeline goes to La Harpe for a couple weeks. Maybe Mom showing up wasn't so great after all. Yeah, the Harrises were a lost cause, and that was pretty much the end of that relationship. So given that so much of Emmeline's later life would be inextricably tied to Relief Society, it's interesting to remember that she arrives in Nauvoo just after it's, quote, disbanded. And hopefully you are getting a little indignant inside until you realize that I put air quotes around disbanded. We've talked to Katie Ludlow Rich on this very podcast about that after all. Carol Mattson makes a good point that Emmeline was sort of a vicarious member, undoubtedly hearing all about it from Elizabeth Ann Whitney, her new sister wife who had been a counselor to Emma.
Oh yeah, Emma. We wonder, did Emmeline even know Emma? There are exactly, consult my papers here, zero mentions of Emma during Nauvoo in the biography. Not a whole lot there. Of course, as you know, Emma and the Brigham Faces are not on super great terms at this point. And part of that rift was, of course, temple stuff. Emmeline and her family would do proxy baptisms, and then the big one. In January 1846, in the kinda sorta finished Nauvoo Temple, Emmeline is sealed to Newell Whitney. Had to have been a special day to share with her dude. Oh, and also Elizabeth Ann and Olive and Elizabeth. That's a different Elizabeth. And Abigail and Elizabeth. That's number three for those keeping score. And Henrietta and Anne. Yeah, having two plain Elizabeths, one Elizabeth Ann, and one Ann hold the Elizabeth, that's not going to confuse anybody. Now, Emmeline is part of a Whitney family that was getting just a little too big for its polygynous britches. Just for kicks, two of those sister wives are friends from the New Salem days. As we've talked about, that flaming sword cuts both ways. It's either more fun to do the pee with friends, or it ends up making it harder to share a husband. Mileage varied greatly on that one.
not a whole lot of Whitneyitos would result from all these plural relationships. Actually, only Emmeline, two daughters, and Anne, one son, would have children with Newell Whitney. Do we argue that therefore the other plural wives were made up? No. No, we don't. Would we think it's silly if someone else made that argument? Yes, we 100% would. After the whirlwind of plural marriage, cue William Clayton singing dramatically in the corner about no toil, no labor, fear, because it's time to hitch up some wagons and wend our way. Emmeline left in February with the Heber Kimball Company. This meant it was time to say goodbye to mom and siblings again after just a couple months. Once again, theoretically, they would follow along shortly. But, and this would be even more clear for a lot of people, real soon, that didn't always play out. As we've talked about, the next couple of years would heavily feature two characters, death and disaffection.
Madsen summarizes simply, she was now a Whitney. Sucky mother-in-law Harris had gone back to Massachusetts. And I found this interesting. Surprisingly, Emmeline would actually visit her a few times over the succeeding decades. Unlike a lot of people in Nauvoo, she actually had the means to go back to where she grew up. Emmeline remembers that Brigham rhetoric covered cases like former mother-in-law. Quote, Brigham preached telling those who were dissatisfied to take their teams and go back. Then, because it was actually illegal to not say this next, Emmeline reminds us, quote, none who did ever prospered. Yeah, we know, we've read Fate of the Persecutors. If you're not on Team Mormons, your face falls off, the maggots consume your brain. Of course, the maggots aren't even metaphorically real half the time. These people go on to be mayors and shopkeepers and teachers and moms and, you know, just normal people. No matter how many times Mormons want it to be otherwise, it didn't play out that way in the real world.
Emmeline's sister wives all had their own birth families to go with. Since Emmeline's crew is still back in Nauvoo, she goes with first wife Elizabeth Ann and Newell. Remember, she's only been in Mormon land for 2 years at this point, but now she's right at the heart of it. She would have unprecedented access to prophetic beards and cracker soup for the journey. Emmeline writes about the mileposts of the trek. She's there when Clayton's new hymn, All Is Well, is performed for the very first time. She's there when the decision is made to establish what becomes Garden Grove, but then her diary goes silent again. Listen, we know winter quarters sucked. But since she's in the high muckety-muck circles, it would have sucked probably at least a little less. She resumed her teaching post and also returned to her poetry, and she even crafted a small handwritten collection of her work and would lend it to her friends with instructions to add their own poems. That's very sweet.
From some periodic letters during this period, Emmeline hears that her mother is trying to scrape some dollars together to get on the road, but it's nearly impossible. They end up staying in Nauvoo until the battle in September 1846 featuring Daniel H. Wells. Hold that thought. Along with other desperately poor Mormons, they're just thrown out. Mom and siblings battle the usual lineup of ailments, typhoid fever, and ague. Diadema can read the shaky handwriting on the wall. She's not going to make it west. She succumbs in Iowa, and the kids are taken by Porter Rockwell to Emmeline in winter quarters. Madsen notes that one of these sisters, named Maria, hates all of this, and it slowly builds into her bailing on Mormonism later.
Mormon battalion dudes leave, and then the Vanguard Company leaves. So the world stops back in winter quarters. No, of course it doesn't. But that's the way it usually seems in the history. Amazingly, women continued to do things. Imagine that. Madsen paints the social world Emmeline lived in. So in addition to her New Salem friends, Emmeline was also good friends with Helen Mar Kimball. And they're just a few months apart in age. They're both young girls at this time. From the journals that survive, we piece together their society. They would have had prayer meetings a few times a week. Helen Mar tells of a particularly interesting one. One of the kids crying so much that they were getting worried. And so Newell K. Whitney shows up and tells them that the dudes were getting worried about the women meeting so often, but he felt the spirit at this prayer meeting. Doesn't that sound just about right? Heaven forbid these women have to have 5 minutes to themselves just to hang out. We need a dude to come chaperone and make sure the spirit's there.
Her relationship with Newell Whitney had deepened, and by the time it came to head finally for Utah, she's pregnant. And we always talk about the Vanguard Pioneer Company of 1847, obviously, but really not much about the next year, 1848.
So wait, at this time she's pregnant, how old is she?
She is now...
in her teens still.
18.
So she's 18. Can you imagine being a teenage 19. Plural wife at this time, hanging out with Helen Mar? What an interesting time. Continue.
So you remember from our first presidency reorganization smackdown that Brigham and Dudes all come back to winter quarters from the Great Salt Lake. So when the wagons roll out in spring 1848, there's three massive groups and each of the first presidency dudes oversees one of them. Given their family connections, it's not too surprising then that Emmeline goes with the Heber Kimball posse. Tender mercies?
Tender mercies indeed. We've heard that that one journal indicates they all wore matching Team Clay in the Potter's Hands t-shirts. We're still verifying that, of course. One part of the pioneer experience that we definitely don't talk about much is, with the explosion of polygamy in late Nauvoo and winter quarters, dudes have to get multiple families west. Not just one wife, but all three of them. In Whitney's case, four wives go with Newell, including Emmeline, while two go with their own birth families. And I think it's really safe to say, it's a really safe bet, but when later family mythology develops about the favorite wife, stuff like that is very much part of the equation.
Emmeline will get an extra merit badge on her Pioneer Scout sash because her song goes, Emmeline sang as she walked and walked and walked and walked with a fetus, because she is pregnant the whole way to Utah. And I always forget this, Lindsay. What, this is that very specific term historians use for this situation.
Fun.
Yep. Okay. Yeah, that's the one. She is 8 months along when she sees the Salt Lake Valley for
the first
time.
Wait a minute. I just want to say, if you have to recreate this on Trek, if you're the 18-year-old and you're the dubbed pregnant one,
don't
who
suggest
has to
anyone
walk.
Recreate no? anything on Trek.
No?
They'll
Bad
do it.
Idea?
They'll do it. Baby bumps will be sold at Deseret Book.
Oh, yeah, you want to push a handcart? Now do it 9 months pregnant. Please don't do that. It was a terrible joke based on her ancestors. Don't. No pregnant tracks, please.
No dead babies. No belly bumps. No. So if you think about her idyllic Massachusetts childhood, that had to have been somewhat of a shock. Mattson summarizes, quote, in her later years, it was not her trail stories with which Emmeline entertained her grandchildren, but rather her memories of her carefree days in her much-missed New England.
It's so sad. That fork in the road when she's like, yeah, I'll get in the waters of baptism. And life sucked thereafter. Like basically everyone else, Emmeline's first Utah home is her wagon box. It would, of course, soon double as a delivery ward since a little squish was soon arriving. Her daughter, Belle, was born a month after arrival, and her middle name is quite fascinating, Modalina. It has quite the backstory. So Newell has been a settler accompanying the army during the War of 1812. And did we mention he's like a billion years older than Emmeline? Well, apparently one of his customers had already had his share of moonshine and was pissed that Newell wouldn't sell him anymore and threatened to beat his pre-Mormon face up. At this point, a native woman takes on Drunkie and saves Newell's life. And her name is Modalina. This story was clearly part of the Whitney family lore since Emmeline used it for Belle's middle name. Belle Modalina.
It took him a year to finish a log house, and it was located on the northeast corner of Main and South Temple in Salt Lake. That's the Joseph Smith Memorial Building is plopped right on top of that now. And now she is the ripe old age of 21, so Emmeline had to enjoy old people things like sewing. And she also joined the Council of Health. At those meetings, Willard Richards would lecture them on the fine art of
hiding behind doors when in danger.
Such disrespect for the good doctor. No. He would talk to them about herbs. This is Thompsonian medicine. And it sounds like Emmeline was a big fan. In fact, later in life, she talked about how she always kind of wished that she could have studied medicine formally.
Time for another instance of episodes crossing paths. Emmeline is friends with the Pratts. No, not the snooty Pratts. Remember Louisa and Addison Pratt from the Polynesian Islands episode? When they go to Tahiti, Emmeline convinces them to take her little brother Hiram with them. I mean, I think you can see the draw of the sailor's life for a kid at this point. Turns out he likes it a little too much, and Emmeline won't see much of him down the road. Like Addison, he votes no thanks on Mormonism, and the Woodwards are going to have a few empty chairs in heaven. Emmeline also joins a relief society organized by Lydia Knight. Wait, no, that's obviously not right. Relief Society didn't come back to life until 1867. Everyone knows that. You, of course, already have that smug smile on your face. The one that says, nice try, Orthodox history. I've already heard Katie Ludlow Rich talk about how that's a bunch of crap. Just because Brigham Young hasn't put his official stamp on something doesn't mean it's not legitimate.
And another squishy baby comes along, and it's another girl. Madsen does a really good job of painting the scenes at these births. She talks about the women who are there as midwife, but then just also as general support. So Diantha Billings had been her midwife in Nauvoo, and she's back on the job this time. Zina Huntington is there, as well as Grandma Wilson. Wasn't really her grandma, but just a family friend. This one is a pretty rough birth, but she and the baby both pulled through. You know who didn't pull through? Newell. Just 5 weeks after baby Mel arrived, Newell Whitney was suddenly dead. This was quite the shock to pass through for new mom.
Though the beginning of the relationship has been weird, odd, very polygamy era Mormon, they had grown to love each other. Emmeline is now functionally a widow twice over, and she's just 22. She's already had several lifetimes full of craziness, and she'll be around more than 70 years, thank you very much. Newell Whitney had been the presiding bishop for a long time, so his sudden death was a community event. He wore all sorts of hats in church and government circles. He's arguably the most influential non-general authority in the territory. Emmeline is still recovering from the birth, so it had to have been a very difficult time.
Brigham Young had never seemed to throw shade at Newell, so that tells you something. Now, we gotta say, Emmeline and Eliza Snow are kind of cut from the same intricately... Now, we should point out that Emmeline and Eliza Snow are cut from the same intricately woven Victorian cloth, if you're happy and you know it. Write a poem. If you're depressed and you know it, write a poem. That kind of program. So here's how she processed things. Such wounds cannot be healed. They are too deep. Oh, it was pitiful, too sad, e'en to relate. Her grief was silent, and she could not weep.
Because she was part of a well-oiled machine of family, one that was better off than most, losing Newell was less of a looming disaster than it could have been. She moves back with Olive Bishop, her Nauvoo roommate. She opens a school which blows up. She soon has 65 students. She probably put a sign that said, "Anyone that threatens teacher gets sent to Hawaii." Remember the F for those who are in the know. Emmeline pulled up her britches and garters and corsets and hoops and whatever the hell she could and got to work. Madsen has great details about her classroom setting. No desks, no blackboard, no more than two copies of any one school book. She would cut out patterns from her paper and copy her poems for the kids to read, and she created handmade rewards from cardboard with colored silk on them. She would have been a good draper mom, I'm just saying.
She has a Stanley. I know she has a Stanley. On the marriage front, Emmeline is now living in open polygamy, Utah. Orson Pratt has announced the worst secret in history to the world, so we're doing the P right on Maine these days. Calendar says it's 1852. Apparently, the music hit Emmeline so hard, made her say, "Oh my lord, thank you for blessing me, with a mind to rhyme and two hyped feet." Because it was indeed Hanmer time. You remember him. Mr. Daniel Hanmer Wells. At 38, he's only 14 years older than Emmeline, so there's that. Emmeline didn't really leave any writings that talked about how their relationship developed. He's better educated than your average bear, so I'm sure Emmeline appreciated that. We don't have any evidence they ever called her carrots, so that's good. I mean, technically, he's the ginger in this story, but that's beside the point.
We already yakked enough yak about him on his own episode, so just a couple bullet points about Danny Boy. Remember, he left his first wife because Brigham Young was hotter, and we're paraphrasing, of course, and then married Louisa Free as part of her Leaving John D. Lee tour. Get it, girl. And he married a plural wife that same year, so Emmeline would be wife number 3, which is definitely not as catchy as wife number 19. Yeah, we get it. What is interesting is that Emmeline apparently proposed to Daniel. Since she didn't tell any of the tales later in life, her letter to Wells in March 1852 seems like it comes totally out of left field. And if you're wondering if the proposal letter is dripping, nay, gushing with Victorianness, oh boy, is it ever. Quote, "Tested at the shrine of truth and virtue, pardon all my simplicity, fondly would my imagination picture to me in my lonely musings," so on and so forth. It's very hot and heavy Victorian. Honestly, you finish reading it and you have to go back and remind yourself what the point is, how much lace is involved, and it was very Hugh Grant fumbly with words character to it. And then Daniel goes radio silent for a month before answering. Rude. Rom-com writers by this point are muttering, "Two on the nose, people. Dial it back a bit."
Daniel, for his part, totally up for the game. His letter is just as drenched in lace and violets and infrequent bathing. "Your letter has been received and favorably considered. If this shall find you still adhering to the same course, I will improve an early opportunity of conferring with you," yada yada. Honestly, I felt like challenging both of them to a duel after reading their letters. Now wait, did we say Emmeline was going to be wife number 3? Well, see, she might have, except for that month of radio silence, because the day before he answered her letter, old Dan married Lydia Alley. Will the real wife, number three, please stand up?
Please stand up?
You're legally required to repeat that. Wait, did we revise our statement to say that Emmeline would be wife number four? Again, if Daniel would have hurried the hell up, then maybe, because Wells also actually married Susan Alley, Lydia's sister, and Hannah Free, Louisa's sister.
Get it, girl.
Before getting back to Emmeline. So Emmeline, after that month, Emmeline crosses the threshold of the Wells house as wife number seven.
Well, at least Daniel can go to the highest level of the celestial kingdom now. He's got all seven.
Hey-o. This theology has been brought to you by Lauren Woolley. You're welcome.
And also, goodbye, because it's time to improve this belated hour and bid you the sweetest farewell with which this humble microphone can impart on you from the heart of one who wishes you the noblest swoonings and gooblies and... Wow, sorry. Those Victorian letters were holding my brain hostage. Back to the presents. Later, B-words.
Seacrest out?
Sort of, but remember, Emmeline still has like 74% of her life left.
That's nearly three quarters.
Seriously, no joke, we may have to do six more episodes just on her, because we can't leave Susan B. Anthony hanging. You just don't do that to someone on a dollar.
Don't let people you love go to sea. And be nice to the Matthew Cuthberts in your life.
Stay away from any and all Ridgepoles.
Why are you so petrified of silence? Here, can you handle this? Did you think about your bills, your ex, your deadlines, when you think you're gonna die? Or did you long for the next Books of Mormons report? Powered by Benchmark Books. I think we've made it clear by now that we have sworn allegiance to Karen Cornwell Matson's excellent biography, Emmeline B. Wells, An Intimate History, published by our friends at the University of Utah Press. It's a very comprehensive biography, but it doesn't get super tangenty. It's well-written, and it's obviously well-researched, thanks to Emmeline's 8 million journals that we mentioned are not only transcribed, but annotated. They're all online at the Church Historians Press website for free $99. We always hear about what a treasure Wilford Woodruff's journals are because they cover so much time. Emmeline's like, yawn. Dude, I outlived you by 23 years. Hopefully, those sound interesting to you. You can check those out at churchhistorianspress.com. As always, get these and everything else in the Mormon universe from Benchmark Books. Check out Benchmark in Salt Lake City or at benchmarkbooks.com.
Blood, oh brother Young, and let his smoke ascend to heaven, brother Brigham, brother Young, and let my breast be cut asunder, brother Young, as an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, brother Young, 'cause I've sinned so gravely, brother Brigham, brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by artist Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.